offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage, a program in which both of us, me, Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and all of you listeners, travel together in our attempt to understand, internalize, and practice the timeless teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. And the added bonus for all of us is our ability to go back into Swami's words, Swami's life itself, and the experiences of many, many devotees to understand some of these verses in reality. And most often when you go through some of these beautiful works, be it the Bhagavad Gita, be it the Upanishads, be it the many discourses of Swami or of the saints that have preceded Swami, all of that only reminds us of how Swami literally gave us an opportunity to watch all of these precepts and messages in action when we observed Swami and how he handled people and how he taught us through his own example. So I think that is the advantage we have of being in the presence of the Master and the ability to go back into the message. As one of my favorite quotes goes, it's a Japanese proverb, I believe, which says that one day with the Master is better than going through thousands of books. And I think that is the experience of anyone who has had the opportunity to come to know of Swami, be it when Swami was physically around or even now. I think that opportunity is always there. So on behalf of all of you, I take this opportunity to offer our most loving gratitude at Swami's lotus feet for that. And with that, let's begin this week's episode. We are still in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and we go through all of the verses, verse by verse, in as much detail as possible. And I think that's why it's taking a little bit of time, but I think it's definitely worth it, because as I've mentioned many times before, the whole idea of this is not to be informed, because I'm sure most of you listeners are familiar with the message of the Bhagavad Gita. Many of you might have gone through it multiple times, and I personally know some of the listeners are very keen students of the Bhagavad Gita already. So the process of going through this entire series is not only to be informed and to learn. Of course, if that happens, you're very glad. It is also to ruminate over the message of the Gita again and again. So I think in that sense, it is all right that we're going slow. And because we're going so slow, I think last week we covered only two verses, verses 47 and 48. And as I mentioned, verse 47 is probably one of the most important verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Arguably, if I could say that, but definitely one of the most quoted verses of the Bhagavad Gita by Swami, and in generally too, the verse that goes Karmanye Vadhika Raste Ma Phaleshu Kadachana, because this is in many ways the crux of the message that Krishna is conveying to Arjuna, what can be classified or named as Karma Yoga, right? So this verse is a summary of that whole topic or that whole philosophy, where he says that you have authority only over the actions that you perform. The adhikara that you have is only over the actions and not on the fruits thereof. Ma phaleshu kadachana, at no moment and never you have any authority over the fruits. And last week we went through the simple understanding of the statement by which is available to all of us. You know, I think most of us overlook it, probably because of our ego, probably because of our inability to look keenly at life experiences. But if we were to reflect on our own lives, we'll know that whatever results come from an action that we have done or come from an effort that we have put, that result can never be claimed as our own, because always the result is based on multiple factors. And that itself is a reason why the result cannot be claimed by one person who is doing the effort, right? Whatever be the effort, the result is dependent on many, many things, on very many multiple factors. And that is why you have control only over the action. In fact, even this idea that you have control over the action is debatable. I will not get into that. I think sometime later in the Bhagavad Gita itself, Krishna will explain how when we talk about adhikara over action, even that is quite limited. And the whole idea of practical spirituality is to leverage that little adhikara that we have over our actions. But we'll leave that for later. We'll come to that later. But at this point, as Krishna is saying, that you have the ability to choose what you want to do, but you do not have the ability to dictate what will be the results of what you do. And when you internalize this idea and you are firmly established in this idea, Krishna clearly says that you will never claim that whatever has happened, it has happened purely because of your efforts, right? And the other thing that we went through was Swami's clarification of a misunderstanding of this particular verse. When Krishna says, Ma Phaleshu Kadachana, people tend to think that one does not have any right over the fruits of one's actions, where Swami very clearly says that you have done your effort, you have put your best foot forward, certainly the results belong to you. Right, you've eaten food, the nourishment has to come to you. You've written your exam well, and if you've done it well, you deserve to pass. Right, nobody can take away something which is deservedly yours. But what Swami was saying is an attitude where one willfully gives up the fruits of one's actions. One finds satisfaction in the action and not the results of the actions. So Swami was talking of that attitude. One has to sacrifice the fruits of one's actions. Karma phala sannyasa. Sorry. Karma phala sannyasa or karma phala tyaga, as it can be described. So that was one of the clarifications we went through. And in the same verse, also Krishna tells Arjuna that when you have this idea established, as you said, that you don't think that you are the karma phala hetu or the sole source or the sole reason for any event occurring, right? Any event occurring is based on multiple combination of things happening around. So you will never take credit that this was achieved by me or I am responsible for this, right? So that is the other thing which Krishna tells in that same verse. And of course, in that verse, he concludes by saying that even though you understand that your actions do not necessarily solely produce the results, do not get attached to inaction. Right? That is again a very, very important aspect of that shloka. In the next shloka, that is shloka number 48, Krishna tells how every action will have the desired result or an undesirable one. Right? If I do something, either the result is positive or it is negative. Either I achieve or I am disappointed. Right? So Krishna is giving Arjuna a tip. Can you make both of these outcomes same in your mind? When we say both of these outcomes, of course, it's understandable that some outcomes can be even in the midway, right? It's not always binary outcomes that we are dealing with in day-to-day life. But there are multiple outcomes which are possible, and some are, right? Suppose you're writing an exam. Yes, the best outcome would be to me securing the first rank in the whole country, right? But between me securing the first rank in the country and me failing in the exam, there are multiple options in between. But depending on, you know, multiple factors, we favor certain outcomes, we don't favor certain outcomes, right? So Krishna is saying that can you make it all similarly or equally acceptable to you in your mind? Siddhi asiddhayoho samobhutva. Can you make them all, can your perception or can your acceptance of them be equal, right? That is one of the things which Krishna says. And this can be achieved when you give up attachment to a certain extent, right? That's what Krishna tells him, that sangam tyaktva, give up your attachment and then you will be able to do this. And that way you will be firmly established in yoga. Yogastaha kuru karmani. Yogastaha. This way you will be established in yoga and then kuru karmani, which means then you can do whatever action that you do, that action will not bind you. And all of this is within what Krishna had told Arjuna, that I will teach you how to develop yoga buddhi, right? That is the beginning of all of this. He says, I'm going to teach you how to develop yoga buddhi, because buddhi, we'll be covering that again in today's verses too, where buddhi is what we use to do anything, our intelligence, our intellect, our discriminatory power, whatever you would like to call that. That is what we use to undertake any action. So Krishna is saying that I'm going to transform that buddhi, or I'm going to teach you a technique to transform that buddhi to yoga buddhi, so that when you perform your actions with this yoga buddhi, you will not be bound by the results of those actions or the actions themselves, right? So in this verse, number 48, Krishna summarizes all of this and he defines what he has been teaching as yoga. He says, Samatvam yoga uchyate. That equanimity towards all the possible outcomes, siddhi and asiddhi, what I want and what I don't want, my equanimity towards them is all what yoga is about. That samatvam yoga uchyate, that samatvam is called yoga. So those were the two verses we covered last week, 47 and 48. We'll continue with the chapter number 2, verse number 49. As always, we'll listen to the rendition of the shloka in Brother Shyam's voice. In the end of it, I'll give you a short translation of that verse. And then we'll go into it deeply. And I think even as we are going through these verses, we understand how a two-line translation of this verse does hardly any justice to the profundity of each of these shlokas, right? And that is the beauty of probably the composition of each of these shlokas and also the language of Sanskrit, right? So I think I will give you a meaning, a succinct two-line meaning, but that is almost never able to capture the real meaning of the shloka. So we'll spend a little more time on that, going through the verse word by word too. But first, we'll listen to the shloka in Brother Shyam's voice, verse number 49 of chapter 2.
Dure nahyavaram karma buddhi yoga dhananjaya buddhau sharanaman vichha kripanaf palahetavaha.
O Dhananjaya, indeed, action is quite inferior to the yoga of wisdom. Take resort to wisdom. Those who thirst for rewards are pitiable indeed. Now, Krishna has described, I think, in a fair bit of detail, the approach of karma yoga and how it is different from regular karma, right? That is what we've been going through. So, in this particular shloka, Krishna emphasizes why one must take to the path of karma yoga by saying doing regular karma driven by one's own likes and dislikes, fears and desires, raga and dvesha, as we've seen, is so much more inferior to doing karma with an attitude of karma yoga, right? So, and that is what is described in this shloka. He says, durena avaram. Avaram means inferior, right? So he says, durena hi avaram, means it is inferior by a long distance. Durena means far. So by a far distance, it is inferior. What is inferior to what? Karma buddhi yogat. Action that is performed following your desires is so much more inferior to buddhi yoga. That's what he says. Durena hi avaram. It is far. It is inferior by a far distance, the action that you perform driven by your desires, compared to actions that are done under the influence of buddhi yoga. He tells Arjuna, O Dhananjaya, buddhau sharanam anvichcha. Take refuge in this intelligent way of doing actions. He says it is so much more inferior, this is so much more superior, so you must take refuge. Buddhau sharanam anvichcha. Take refuge in this kind of actions, or in this intelligent way of doing actions. Then he makes a statement which is very, very interesting and worth pondering upon. He says, kripanaha falahetavaha. Kripanaha falahetavaha. Falahetus are those that perform actions for the sake of the fruits, right? I think this term has already occurred in a couple of verses back. Falahetavaha. Those who perform actions for the sake of the results alone, for the sake of the fruits alone. Kripanaha. He says those people can be defined as kripana. And the word kripana means small-minded people or miserly people. Kripanaha falahetavaha. those who are constantly driven by fruits are miserly people. Krishna doesn't say that those who do normal karma are foolish or brainless, right? If he were to say that, it is like branding them as incapable of doing karma yoga. But he doesn't say that. Of course, I am saying as though it is some third person that Krishna is addressing. Krishna is actually referring to you and me, right? Because we all the time, at least for a good part of our life, all our actions are done for the sake of fruits and results. So this is not Krishna telling somebody, he's actually referring to you and me, right? So he's saying that we all do actions with an eye on the results, right? And Krishna doesn't call us dull wits or something like that. If he said so, that would be like, you know, you're incapable when you say that someone is retarded or somebody is dull-witted or somebody is stupid, which means that that person is not capable of doing something more intelligent, right? And that is why it is offensive to use such language in cultured discourse. We never use these words because when you brand somebody as an idiot or when you say words like these, which are very strong, you are branding that person as incapable of doing something which is more intelligent. But Krishna doesn't do that. He calls people like us kripanaha, the miserly. A miser is one who has the money to spend but doesn't spend it, right? That's the definition or the simplest definition of a miser. Similarly, we all have the inbuilt capacity to perform actions in this superior way that Krishna is talking about, in this manner of karma yoga, but we are happy and satisfied doing mundane regular karma. That is why Krishna uses the word kripanaha or the miserly, right? And this word in many ways perfectly describes whatever Krishna has been listing out as the distractions to karma yoga, right? When somebody wants to perform actions in the karma yoga approach, what distracts them away and what turns them back into doing regular karma? And I think a few of those points we also quoted from the Gita Vahini, right? Let us try to understand that by considering the mindset of a miserly person. Money is meant for buying things, right? And most often the things that we buy make our life a little more easy, right? Be it the footwear that we wear, or be it the cot that we sleep on, or the appliances that we have in the house. All of these are bought by money, and all of these things are utilities that make living easy. But a miserly person leads a life of self-deprivation, right? Because one does not want to spend the money, one has the money but doesn't want to spend it. He would rather hoard the money than spend it on utilities and make one's life easy, right? And why would a person hoard money in that manner to such an extent that one denies oneself of comfortable life? One of the reasons is insecurity, right? What if when I really need the money, I don't have it? What if tomorrow there is a winter day and I don't have this money and, you know, I always a miserly attitude. And when we say a miser, it is not necessarily the extreme nature of miserliness. I think all of us have a little bit of that miserliness in our approach to life, probably, right? I'm just making a general statement here. And if you look at why we are miserly or why we are thrift in our expenditure, it is always this insecurity of what will happen when I have a need tomorrow and I don't have it, right? That is what stops us from going all out and spending what we have, or sometimes even using it to help others. We always think that, oh, what will happen when I need it, I will not have it, right? Similarly, Swami has said in the Gita Vahini, and we had discussed that, why do we hesitate to do action and not bother about the results? Why is that hesitation? Why do we not venture into that karma yoga? Sometimes it is a feeling of insecurity, right? What if I don't get my due? What if I do my work, I offer the best of my services, and I don't get the returns? What am I to do then, right? Just like how a miser thinks, now I have the money, but what if tomorrow there is a big need and I don't have? The same similar kind of a miserliness is what stops a person from performing karma yoga, isn't it? The other reason, going back to the miser's mindset, the other reason a miser doesn't want to spend money is is a kind of a mix-up of priorities or the understanding of what money is meant for, isn't it? As I just said, money is for leading a comfortable life, probably to eat healthy food, live in a clean place, buy things which make help us lead a dignified life, help our family lead a dignified life. But when a miser begins to hoard money, this idea is lost. What is the purpose of money is lost, right? One starts thinking that if I have a huge bank balance or if I have this huge savings, then I will be seen as a rich man, which means you've mixed up your idea of what is money meant for. A mixed up priority leads to this cloudiness of what is the very purpose of what you are gathering, right? In a very, very similar fashion, when we all become karma phala hetus, right? Those who perform actions merely for the results that the action gives. Those who do karma with the results in their mind. We have lost the idea of what karma is actually meant for. Just like how a miser has lost the idea of what is money meant for. We have been given this ability to choose and do actions, right? We have been given that authority, the adhikara, as Krishna says. So what should I use it for? What should I use this authority I've been given for? Right now, we are using it only for pursuing our raga and to avoid ardveshas, right? If we really look at it, this even the animals, birds and beasts do. And they do not have the adhikara over their karmas, right? And that's a very important point that we have to keep. Why? Because they do not have the buddhi or the discriminative power. Oftentimes, Swami has spoken about this, the difference between being a man and being an animal, being a human and being a beast. The difference is, if it can be pinpointed to one thing, it is this discriminative power or buddhi. And it is this buddhi that makes us adhikaras over our karmas. I can choose whether I want to do. I can choose whether I want to do or I don't want to do. And when I do, what I do and how I do, right? But an animal or a bird or a beast does not have that authority. It is always driven by instinct, right? That's what Swami would always say. They're always driven by instinct and they do not have this discriminative power. They are programmed in a certain manner. So in a way, you can say that they are like children who don't have the choice of, let's say that a child who is in a very rich family, they do not have the choice of how the money that they actually inherit is spent, right? Suppose I'm an 8-year-old kid and I've inherited huge property. I do not have the discrimination of how I spend it, even though the money is mine. So similarly, though the birds and beasts and animals perform actions, they do not have the power of choosing whether to do or not do or to do it in a better way. They have the choice, they've been deprived of the choice merely because they do not have the discriminative power. When we say that the actions are programmed in the minds of animals, what does that really mean? On the basis of what is it programmed? If we were to ask that, it is self-preservation, right? I think this is again a topic we have spoken about before in the Gita series and was extensively in the Answering Book program. I've mentioned this. One of the roles of the mind or the physical brain in the body is always self-preservation. So that an animal always thinks like, this is good for me. This I want and this I don't want. So when we become humans, we have been gifted this adhikara over our karmas. But what do? We still are operating under the same I want this, I don't want this parameters, raga and dvesha. Only thing is, in the humans, the wants have become more advanced and more sophisticated, if you were to look at it that way. Instead of just saying that I want this particular food because it is nourishing and it is going to keep me alive, we have more sophisticated kind of foods and, you know, something which is deep fried and something which tastes different, you know, ice creams and all of that. We have made it a little more sophisticated using this intelligence, but still, instead of just saying that I want the shelter, we've made it a luxury home or whatever it is. So two things from this is, one, we are still operating like animals when we are still saying that I want this, I don't want this, and that is the basis of how we are exercising our adhikara over our karmas. And secondly, at least animals have a limit to their desires, right? That's what Swami would say. Animals' desires have a limit. But if you look at our needs and wants, they've become desires of the mind, and desires of the mind can never be satisfied. And that is why Krishna tells Arjuna, Buddhau Sharanam Anvicha, take refuge in the Buddhi. Unlike animals, you have a Buddhi, a higher intelligence. So take refuge in that. And when he says Buddhi or intelligence, Swami will often say this, there are two types of Buddhi. One is the regular intelligence, which probably we use for our everyday activity, you know, whatever science and technology that we have to improve our living, to improve the conditions of people and, you know, how we lead our life and all of that. That is one kind of intelligence. And the other is, Swami would say, spiritual discrimination. But one could, I think, I would not be wrong in saying that both come from the same intellectual ability to discriminate between right and wrong and good and bad. But when we say spiritual discrimination, you give the same intellect spiritual inputs to operate with. Now let's say we give the intellect the mandate, give me more comfort, give me more profit, give me more success. And then all the inputs that we give to the Buddhi are also the worldly scenario of comparisons, of jealousy, of, you know, so-and-so is like this and so is so successful. Those are the inputs we give the Buddhi, and the output we ask from it also is, can you make my life more comfortable? Can you make me more successful? Right? And the Buddhi also delivers accordingly. But to the same intellect, if we constantly give spiritual inputs of what is real and what is unreal, what is ephemeral and what gives true happiness, and then give it the mandate, O Buddhi, give me the method for more peace and fulfillment, then the same intellect now will begin to operate as the spiritual intellect or Buddhi, which Swami is referring to. And that is what Krishna has been doing. Right? He told, I'll teach you Buddhir Yoga. So he is tuning the intellect towards spirituality and saying, with this attitude, now you go ahead and do your actions. Right? But if we were to come back to karma, to what karma is meant for in all of this, because that's what we said, you know, the comparison that we did between a miserly person and somebody who's involved more in regular karma than in karma yoga, right? So what is karma meant for? We said that is the confusion. Just like how a miser does not know what is money meant for, a person who is lost in regular karma does not know what is karma meant for. When we have the authority over actions, and when we choose to use the Buddhi, or as Krishna says, take refuge in the Buddhi, we will look at the utility of karma very, very differently. Instead of seeing karma as a means to achieve what we want and avoid what we don't want, we will now see it as a means to purify the mind, or as Swami would so often say, as achieving chitta shuddhi, purification of the mind, or antakarana shuddhi, the purification of the inner instruments. So what is the purpose of Karma Yoga itself? If you were to look at it in the larger picture, it is to prepare the mind to receive the wisdom of jnana, or wisdom of universal, the universal wisdom, if you could put it that way, Brahma Jnana or Jnana or Supreme Jnana, whatever you like to call that. Karma Yoga is meant only to prepare the mind for that. And how is the mind prepared? It is prepared through this process of making it pure, giving it chitta shuddhi. Purity of the mind is mandatory for it to receive that jnana. And karma, or doing one's duty, as Swami has said many, many times in many discourses, is one of the best ways to achieve chitta shuddhi. Right? And karma yoga is probably the best way to perform karma itself. So when Krishna calls a person who does karma for the results alone as a miser, he also means that they have lost this context of what is the purpose of money itself, right? So one way of looking at it is, you have the ability to do karma yoga and you are stuck up doing karma. The other way is, you've lost the context of what karma is for, right? The karma can give you the highest, but you're using it to just satisfy your worldly desires. In fact, in the next verse, Krishna reiterates this point very, very beautifully. We'll listen to that. We'll go to that verse number 50. We'll listen to the verse in Brother Shyam's voice. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss this in a little more detail.
बुद्धियुक्तो जहातीह उभे सुकृत दुष्कृते तस्माद् योगाय युज्यस्व योगः कर्मसु कौशलम्।
Endowed with wisdom or evenness of mind, one casts off in this life both good and evil deeds. Therefore, devote thyself to yoga. Yoga is skill or excellence in action. The role of the buddhi is to discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad, right? That's what we've established. That's why I call it nischayatmika buddhi, the intellect that is meant for decision making, right? Nischayatmika buddhi. And it makes the decision through the basic idea of what is good and what is bad. So this is when probably a task is being done, right? When we take up a task, it says that this is good, this is the right way of doing it, this is how you have to go about performing this particular action. When our focus is on the results, when the focus is on the results of what we do, the buddhi acts there also in a very, very similar fashion. When I'm taking up an action, it says this is good action, that is bad action. But when my focus turns to the results of the action, there again the buddhi operates in a very, very similar manner and says, this is an acceptable result, this is an unacceptable result. Or this is a pleasant outcome, this is an unpleasant outcome. We cannot blame the buddhi for this, because the buddhi in that sense is only continuing to do what it always does, which is discrimination. And this discrimination of the results as being pleasant or unpleasant is dangerous, because eventually it is going to cloud the way the discrimination at the point of doing the work itself happens. Let's try to understand that a little more, and let me try to explain that a little more. For instance, I know that I have to be an honest person. I know that I have to be speaking the truth at all situations and scenarios. At that basic discrimination, I think all of us have. But the mind is also constantly seeing what is the consequence of me speaking truth and in various situations, and the mind is also constantly judging what is the response to me being an honest person, right? And it is judging the outcome as being pleasant or unpleasant. So the next time when I have to speak the truth in a particular situation, the mind will remember that, hey, the last time I spoke truth, I got into trouble. So should I really speak the truth? Should I really be honest? So even to follow the idea of basic discrimination when we are performing the action, to a certain extent, I think we must have the attitude of not being disturbed by the consequences, right? But here Krishna is saying something very, very interesting. We'll come back to that strain of thought. Buddhi yuktaha, one who's endowed with buddhi, and here Krishna is certainly referring to yoga buddhi from the continuation of the previous verses, right? And just to refresh our memory, he described the yoga as samatvam. Samatvam yoga uchyate, he had said in the verse that we covered last week. So Krishna says, one who has this buddhi yuktaha, jahati, can get rid of ubhe, sukrita dushkrite, both good and bad, iha, in this life itself. This combination word, sukrita dushkrite, can be defined as good and bad. It can also be defined as sin and merit, right? So Krishna is saying one can go beyond sin and merit in this life itself if one has yoga buddhi. How is that possible? How do you say that you can go beyond sin and merit? That is why it's always important to keep in the mind the whole process of this whole thing. Transcending good and bad through goodness. This is the essence of the spiritual path, right? Many people would often ask this question. So eventually we have to give up good and bad, and we have to go beyond good and bad. So why should we be judgmental of others? Why should we be judgmental of our own actions? Why should we say that this is good and that is bad? I think a lot of us get into this confusion, and that is why it is always important to remember that this is the process. When we develop samatvam with regard to the outcome of our actions, which is what is yoga buddhi, our discrimination when we are performing actions will be crystal clear. This is a very, very important point. When we have, I'll just repeat that again, when we develop equanimity or samatvam with regard to the outcomes of the actions, I don't care whether I'm going to get into trouble being an honest person or not. I don't care whether I'll get into trouble if I'm speaking the truth in this particular situation. If I have that detachment to the outcome, automatically my discrimination when I'm performing the action is going to be crystal clear, right? And then when we perform actions in this manner with perfect discrimination, it will eventually lead to chitta shuddhi. So which will slowly take us to that state when we get this chitta shuddhi, which is beyond all the dvandvas of good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant, right and wrong, right? So to attain that supreme equanimity or samatvam, we must start with the samatvam with regards to karma phala. And I think that is the essence of whatever Krishna has been telling here, right? When we talk of equanimity, we talk of samatvam, we get mixed up in this manner. The process which Krishna is telling here is so beautiful. First develop samatvam with regard to the fruits. Start with that. And eventually you will see that the mind gets purified and then you go beyond good and bad in the complete supreme sense, right? So as we saw, when there is yoga buddhi, one's discrimination will become very sharp. One's understanding of right and wrong becomes more clear. So when we take up actions with such a clear mind, won't the actions that we perform be perfect? And that is what Krishna tells in the second line of this verse, which again is a very, very important thing. He says, Tasmat yogaya yujyasva. Therefore, commit yourself to yoga. Krishna says, commit yourself, yogasya yujyasva. This does not come naturally, right? I think that is again a point to be remembered. It is not natural for us to turn towards karma yoga. The mind has to be trained to do karma yoga naturally, because the innermost instinct is the animal instinct, as we said. And the animal instinct is always about self-preservation. I want this, I don't want this, I need this, I don't need this. And in the human frame, we are only bringing that in a different form, right? So the effort has to be made to commit ourselves to karma yoga. So he says, Tasmat yogaya yujyasva. Commit yourself to yoga. And then Krishna says, Yogaha karmasu kaushalam. Yoga in action will express itself as kaushalam or excellence or skillfulness. When I'm not bothered about the results, it should not show as indifference in the work that I do, but it should show up as excellence. Yogaha karmasu kaushalam. And that will happen with all these aspects of karma yoga working in tandem, right? It is not any one of them which creates this yoga, karma, kaushalam. It is all of them working together. And probably at this point, it would be quite appropriate for us to quickly summarize all the dimensions, because it all converges at this particular point where Krishna says, Krishna has clearly given us an idea of what is the attitude you should have when you take up an action, what should be the attitude you should have after the action has been performed, but what will be the result of that when the action is being performed. All three is covered and it all comes together in this particular verse. So probably we'll just quickly step back and summarize whatever Krishna has told of all the multiple dimensions of this karma yoga. First, Krishna said, Nitya sattvastho bhava. First and foremost, be good. That is the primary quality. I should not have the desire to benefit at the cost of another person. I should not have the desire to progress in an unfair manner, right? So that is the basis. That is not at all compromised. Basic morality is the starting point. Nitya sattvastho bhava. Then comes what we refer to as the commonsensical understanding. Karmani eva adhikarahate ma phaleshu kadachana. You have control and authority only over what you do. The results depend on so many, many factors. Just this understanding, just this commonsensical understanding has to be cultivated. We have to remind ourselves of this again and again. And then you will know that you are not the karma phala hetu, the one who is the sole cause of whatever is the outcome of the actions that you have performed. And all this should not lead us to get attached to inaction or the desire to give up all actions altogether. That's why Krishna says, Ma astu te sangaha akarmani. Do not ever get attached to inaction. The next is to take up to action without being worried about the results. Sangam tyaktva siddhi asiddhayoho samobhutva. Krishna had said in the verse that we went through last week, give up attachment to any one particular outcome. Try to make the positive and negative outcomes of your actions equally acceptable to you. And we had seen how this is practically possible. I think last week we spent quite a lot of time of how this is very, very easily achievable, and we do this in many, many aspects of our life and how we can practice this, right? So that is the next aspect. He says, even as you're taking up an action, before you take up that, multiple outcomes are possible. Can you make all of them equally acceptable to you in your mind? Or as we saw last week, if you can make the most negative outcome also a little, I mean, look at it and say that, okay, it's not so bad. You know, I'm applying for this job. The worst thing that could happen is I don't get the job. So if I don't get the job, there might be some reason for that, and probably I'm going to get another better job later next week. So this attitude will make the various outcomes of our actions equally applicable to us, right? So that is the next aspect of it. And when I am not bothered about the result, I will concentrate on the work at hand and use all my discrimination to perform that task. And that will lead to karma sukaushalam, excellence in whatever I do. Then when the results come, be it positive or negative, we do not let that trouble us, because we know it was very little to do with my actions, right? I am not the karma phala hetu. It was not completely because of my actions. We only take that aspect which will make my karma more kaushalam. I think that is again a very, very important point. It does not mean that there is no self-improvement. There is a certain aspect of the result which also help us improve our karma. Let's say I'm a tennis player. I've trained very, very hard. I play my best. And in spite of all of that, I lose a match. I should not be sinking into discrimination because both loss and victory, I should treat them equally. But if there are certain aspects as to why I lost that particular match, you know, where are my weaknesses, or where did I fail, or where did I not perform well, I can use those points only to make the next time when I go out to play tennis, I will be a better player, which means I am using the outcome to define better or refine my action. I'm only making my karma more kaushalam using the results, right? So that should always be there. It is not that don't bother about the results means we do not account whatever happens in the results. That is not the attitude, right? So that is something that needs to be kept in mind. Then when we continue to act in this manner, we will develop chitta shuddhi and we will be on the path to acquire wisdom. So this whole process can be triggered if we desire or aspire for something more than yoga and kshema, right? That is the beginning of all of this. If we can give up just the attitude that I'm doing actions only to protect myself, feed myself, keep safe all those who belong to me, or protect the happiness of all those who belong to me, yoga and kshema. You must look at action as a means to achieve something more than just this. That is the beginning of all of this. And what is that that is more than all of this? It is if we can use action to seek freedom from bondage. And that is why Krishna spoke about Sankhya Yoga in the very beginning. He gave a glimpse of what is our destiny. He gave a glimpse of what is our true nature, what is our true wealth, so that we will have the aspiration to live life in that manner. In fact, the verse which follows next, I think, Krishna again mentions what is the ultimate gain of all of this, karma yoga, buddhi yoga, whatever you would like to call it, that what is it that you're going to achieve by all of that? That Krishna explains in the next verse. We'll listen to that. Verse number 51. I'll give you a short meaning after we listen to the verse and we'll discuss about it.
కర్మజం బుద్ధియుక్తా హి ఫలం త్యక్త్వా మనీషిణః జన్మబంధ వినిర్ముక్తాః పదం గచ్ఛంత్యనామయం.
Those who are devoted to wisdom, they becoming men of enlightenment by giving up the fruits produced by actions, reach the state beyond evils by having become freed from bondage of birth. Now imagine there is a very, very poor man, right? And every day he struggles for his living, he does not have enough food to feed himself, he does not have enough food to feed his family, and every day he is listening to the crying of his children who are hungry at home. He comes back home every day after an entire day's of effort. He's not able to bring enough food home, or he's not able to earn enough to feed them. Imagine somebody who is living life so pathetically. And I think, unfortunately, there are any number of people who are living like that even today in this world, especially in countries like ours. You can imagine the plight of somebody who is going through such kind of poverty, such pathetic life, to be able to listen to have to witness the pain and hunger of your own children, little children, is probably the worst curse that one could go through, right? Imagine a person who is like that, who is living life so pathetically. And somebody comes to this poor man who is living life like this and says, hey, you're living like this, don't you know that your grandfather was a very, very rich person? And he had earned a lot of money, and he had, accumulated a huge treasure. And I remember that he had told me that he has buried it under your house in the backyard or something like that, right? Somebody comes and tells him this. What will this poor man who's living life so horribly, what will he do? Won't he immediately drop everything else and start digging to find the treasure, right? Even more hypothetical situation of this person being a manual laborer, right? So every morning he goes out and he's probably laying roads and he's digging wells somewhere. So that is the action that he always does. But the moment this information is given to him, he will not go out and dig wells in the open somewhere working for somebody else. He will start digging his own backyard, isn't it? So the same action that he has been doing he's been doing all his life in trying to feed his family, won't he start doing that action now to completely relieve him of this poverty that he's stuck in? Same is the case with all of us. We are all leading such pathetic lives. We're being tossed up and down by pain and sorrow. We constantly live in fear. Who will harm us? Who will hurt us? I know I have this money. Who will take away this property? This land belongs to me. What will I do if somebody comes and grabs this land from me? What will happen to my future? You know, will my children be happy? Will my children have good future? Will this happen? That happen? We are constantly living in that fear and insecurity, right? Sankhya Yoga is revealing to us, and it is giving us this most empowering message. You are not this body. You cannot be touched by fire. You cannot be drowned. You do not have a beginning. You do not have an end. Imagine that is the greatest piece of information that has been given to you. You are all of this. Don't cry. There is no reason for you to cry, because you're beyond pain. You're beyond poverty. You're beyond any kind of sorrow, right? That's what Sankhya Yoga, the first few verses that Krishna spoke of, were. When you imagine yourself to be that, the description of the self which Krishna gives in those first few verses. And if we look at ourselves the way we are living a life today, for a mere pittance of a salary, how much we struggle for small, small things, how we lose sleep over it and how we lose our peace of mind over it. So when we are given this piece of information that Krishna gave in the form of Sankhya Yoga, immediately we must start wondering, if that is so, why am I living like this? What should I do now to attain that state which truly belongs to me, right? Isn't that what our first reaction will be? And that is the digging process, right? When this poor man has been told that you have a treasure, what he does is immediately starts digging. So similar to that digging is this process of Karma Yoga that Krishna is teaching this is all the wealth that belongs to you. As Swami would say, Amrutasya Putraha, you are the children of immortality. Immortality is your birthright. Immortality is your inheritance. And when that is the case, Krishna is telling, now what do you do to attain that? What do you do to break the shackles of all this bondage and reach out to that which is truly yours? And that is Karma Yoga, right? So after having been told that this is what I rightly belongs to me, or, you know, the poor man who has been told that this is the treasure, will the poor man say that, okay, let the treasure be there, I'll dig some other time, but right now, you know, I'll go in. So this money lender has told me that he'll give me this much money for this much interest, so I'll go and take that money, right? That would be a stupid thing to do. You would immediately take to that action which will eventually relieve you completely from this bondage of poverty, right? Same is the case if we would continue to do karma in the normal way, inspired by raga and dvesha, even after being told about this idea of what our true nature is, right? Shouldn't we say that right now let me try practicing karma yoga? And when we do that, Krishna promises nothing less than the ultimate state. He says, buddhi yuktaha, those who have the perspective, or those who have that buddhi which Krishna has been talking of so far, phalam tyaktva, who have given up the fruits, manishinaha, the wise who have done all of this, karmajam, the results of the actions of such people. Karmajam means that which is born out of actions. So such people, buddhi yuktaha and phalam tyaktva, manishinaha, such people, the actions they perform, what is born out of that action? Karmajam, he says, janma bandha vinimuktaha. The results of those actions will be such that it will lead to freedom from birth and death. Janma bandha vinirmuktaha. Janma bandha vinirmuktaha. And he goes on to say, padam gacchanti. And the word padam, Shankaracharya beautifully explains that as the ultimate state, or the supreme state, which is none other than moksha itself. He says, padam gacchanti. You will reach that ultimate state, anamayam, without any miseries whatsoever. So Krishna is promising the ultimate state of freedom, release from birth and death as a result of actions, right? As a result of doing actions in this way, he says all this shall be karmajam, got through action, not through meditation, not through any other form of tapas or anything like that. He says all of this is karmajam. Through your actions you can get, but the only condition is it is not through regular action that is inspired by raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, yoga and kshema, but it is through actions that are backed by yoga buddhi and detachment from fruits, right? So that is the greatest thing that he is blessing. So even after, and that is the sequence of events, right? So beautifully, first Krishna gives the Sankhya Yoga and prepares the ground. He says, look, you're not this, you're not this limited body, you cannot be touched by pain, you cannot be touched by death, you are never born, you're never going to die, right? All of that he says. And then the individual starts wondering, what should I do to break from this bondage that I'm in and reach that state, right? What should I do to free myself? And then Krishna says that, you know, right now you're doing karma in this manner, and that karma is binding you, right? And this is again a very, very important point that has to be kept in mind. And when we are performing actions, the basic level of discrimination is punya and papa. That is merit and sin. Is it a good action? Is it a bad action? And that definition is very, very simple. As Swami would many times reiterate, paropakaraya punyaya papaya parapedanam. What is merit? To be of use, to be helpful to others is meritorious actions. To in any way harm another person is sin. Papaya parapedanam. To harm another person is sin. So a sinful action is that, right? So you could lead an entire life refraining from sin. I have never harmed anybody in life, but you could still be doing action that binds. action that binds is different from sinful actions, right? We all may be leading lives of a very good person, but if we are still doing actions driven by the desire of what that action will give us in return, we are still doing action that binds, right? So Krishna is giving this opportunity through this discourse by saying, I'm going to teach you same actions. You do not have to do any different actions. Imagine if you look at it, a warrior is probably farthest from the idea of spirituality. Probably that's why this entire stage has been set up. You know, you can think of a teacher as a spiritual profession. You can teach, you can think of somebody who's a doctor or someone who's a, you know, any of those. I mean, we have in our mind that these are all noble professions, right? We can think of all of this as being closer to spirituality. You're talking of a warrior here, right? Who is ready to go and massacre people in the warfare. You're talking of him, and Krishna is teaching him a method by which he can do the same actions as a warrior and get liberated from the bondage, right? So that is the beauty of the whole setting. Senayor Ubhayor Madhye, between the two armies which are ready to pounce on each other and kill each other, Krishna is telling this warrior, go and fight, right? That is the essence of all the Bhagavad Gita. He says, go and fight, which means you do not have to change what you're doing. If you are a housewife, you continue to do what you're doing. If you're a software programmer, you continue to do what you're doing. If you're a person who builds houses, you're a civil engineer, continue to do what you're doing. You do not have to change. You only have to change the attitude with which you're doing your actions. The yoga buddhi is all that you need to develop. And once you develop that, then that is what we went through. What you are supposed to think before you take up the actions, how you're supposed to act when you're doing the action, and after having completed the action, what should be your attitude. All of that together forms this idea of karma yoga, and it'll keep increasing the ability to become a karma yogi more and more the actions are performed in that manner. That will lead to chitta shuddhi, and that chitta shuddhi will prepare the mind to receive the jnana, and that jnana will liberate, right? That is what Krishna says in that last verse that we went through. Janma bandha vinirmuktaha. It can release you from this bondage. So it is not merely merit and sin. Even a meritorious action can be a binding action. What Krishna is teaching here is an action that liberates, right? And that is what makes this entire lesson of the Bhagavad Gita so very, very important, and how much more grateful we are. We should be to Swami that we are going through the Bhagavad Gita, we inspired by the love and reverence that we have for Swami, and we always have the opportunity to fall back on His words, because even the purest form of Bhagavad Gita can get lost in its context, because you know, any number of people like me are going to come and give their own interpretations, right? But time and again, turn to the source itself and get clarity is the opportunity that we have to go back to the Gita Vahini, to go back to the many discourses on the Bhagavad Gita, or for that matter, everything that Swami speaks is the same wisdom that has been given out in the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and all the scriptures of the world, right? So I'll join you all in expressing once again our heartfelt gratitude to Swami for that opportunity to go back to His words, to learn from the source itself. I most humbly offer this entire effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'll join you all again next week for the continuation of this Triune Pilgrimage, the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Sai Prakash. I think Brother Bishu is not here for the Vahini Satsang. Brother Sai Prakash will take you through the Vahini Satsang. That's going to be the last segment of today's Thursday Live. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of the Gita series.